Hi everyone, this is Matimba Swana from Black and Brown and Bioethics, and you are listening to the Power and Privilege in Academia podcast, the show that gets together with academics to question academic hierarchies, structures, and conventions, unpack their inherent issues, and find solutions together. We have a bonus podcast for you. The area of power and privilege is so vast and extends beyond some of the areas we have already covered. We initially recorded the episodes in 2023, and the bonus episodes were recorded a year later. This bonus episode in the Power and Privilege series is with Dr. Peter Winter and Dr. Alan Chamberlain. Pete is a senior research associate and sociologist at the University of Bristol. He specialises in science and technology studies with a focus on analysing complex social technical systems, particularly those involving artificial intelligence applications. Alan is a principal research fellow in the Mixed Reality Lab, computer science at the University of Nottingham. His main interests lie in the creative use and application of artificial intelligence framed by human-computer interaction. In today's episode, we talk about public and community engagement with research, barriers, and who gets to engage in research, making research engagement accessible, and elitism in academia. We're really excited to have you on the Power and Privilege podcast, Pete and Alan.
Hello. Hi, Matimba. Thanks for the introduction. I'm Peter Winter. I'm a sociologist of science and technology at the University of Bristol. And I research socio-technical dimensions of emerging technology, specifically with a focus on emerging medical and biotechnologies and things like that.
I work at the University of Nottingham. I'm in a research lab called the Mixed Reality Lab. So something for you to think about there. It's based in computer science. And so the focus of my research, again, is about designing emerging technologies. I guess my research has more of a social feel to it as well. Sometimes it involves artists, sometimes it involves musicians. Sometimes it relates back to sort of medicine. So it's kind of working with people to try and understand what their issues are and feed that back into design.
Both of you have mentioned the social side of your research. And what I'm interested in is, why is it important to work with people?
So I've got a few thoughts on this. And so in my experience, you really... If you want to make something that works for somebody, or you want to understand about people or the opportunities that a technology such as AI might offer, or the issues around engaging with those technologies, you need to go out and understand and discuss this with people. So the important thing is that, you know, people are intelligent. People can tell you all about the issues. They can tell you all about their worries, emotions, concerns. And it's certainly not the case that if you're working and solely focusing upon a product or technology, that you're going to understand what the issues are around the use, the adoption, the implication, the fears of the people using it, as is the case with AI. Some people are frightened about losing their jobs. So it's really important to get out there and understand that. And as part of that, one of the core issues for me that's certainly come to the fore in the last decade is, how do you go out there and work with people who are representative of the wider population? So in terms of my research, this morning I was looking at a UKRI report, and I noticed that they're identifying some gaps within a certain context. And it's kind of, you know, they're not looking at people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds were seen as a gap. Now, arguably, that's the majority of the UK population. Aging population, well, we're living in a society where everybody's getting older. There are more older people, however that's defined. But I don't think at the moment we're not fully appreciating that, and I'll pass on to Peter after this because he's got some really interesting stuff to think about in this respect, is if we don't represent those people in our research, so the people that we engage with, and those people, whoever they are and however they're categorized, are not represented as part of the research team. So, and that could be, you know, anybody in that team, whether it's sociologists, psychologists, technologists. If you don't get an appropriate amount of people that can understand each other and have some kind of mutual understandings that feed into the academic discussion and findings, then when you start to think about what those findings might be from the research, and you think about how these might impact upon policymakers, sort of politicians, the third sector, upon legislation, lawmaking, and on regulation, then the information that you've got to work with, the data, isn't true. It's not authentic. And arguably, it's not worth the paper it's written on.
Yeah, I think this question of why is it important to work with people, it's really come to the fore now with the post office scandal. They just didn't listen to anyone. And it's important to work with people because I think you need to hold, it's a route to stop these companies exploiting people ultimately and making sure that these kind of things don't happen where there are legal loopholes and we end up seeing these companies who ultimately end up bankrolling or even if it's money from the public, they become black boxes in themselves. And, you know, if we had more engagement from end users and the public and different sections of the public, like Alan mentioned, especially people from, you know, different socioeconomic backgrounds, we wouldn't have things like the post office scandal. We wouldn't have things like Grenfell because these voices would be included in decisions.
You've got a really good point there, Peter, because it's kind of using the term voice. If you're not engaging with people, you're not giving people voice. And if you've not got data on people and you're not working with them, you're almost excluding them from having voice. So you know that when you look at, even when you look at the data that's collected on people, that comes from data, if you look at the categorizations, if there's certain categorizations that are not in that data, those people are made invisible. So it becomes, you start to think about engagement with the best will in the world. You think about, oh yeah, public engagement, policy, lawmakers, X, Y, Z. And it's like bolted onto the end of a project. Whereas some of the stuff that I've done in the past, and I certainly know with Peter, it's kind of, you have to think about this really early on. And you have to go and speak to people and say, how do you, the taxpayer, that the person who's having input, the person who's valuable in this project as somebody that we might help and that you will help us, there's some kind of mutual negotiation and respect in that relationship. How do you want to be engaged with? Because sometimes workshops on a wet Wednesday afternoon for 2 hours, what are they worth? What you want is this continual and meaningful engagement that feeds back and raises the, and enables us to see and perhaps avoid some of the issues that Peter's just raised. And I suppose in some respects, you can sort of think about it of, let's do this and then engage with people. But an engagement is multifaceted. So you need engagement in your research to do the academic work. You might need engagement. You often see it, don't you, on LinkedIn and all that kind of stuff. There are four or five people sitting on a stage at a very, very swanky venue, 18th century, backlit. There's a panel, and that they invite people from, I don't know, from organisations so that they can give a high-level perspective on something. And then you get other stuff, don't you, where there's a great event that's going to happen, Innovation Showcase in Gravesend, and organised by the Fourth Portal. And that's in Gravesend. What the organisation is trying to do is get academics, technologists, policymakers, all kinds of people involved. They're even engaging with the local employment centre to give people opportunities so they can come and speak to people to find out what research is all about or what people are doing. But it's not academic work written for academics. It's kind of some academics going out there and saying, actually, we're really interested in your point of view. Can I show you what we're doing? Can we get your kind of opinion on this? And I don't know. I think the bigger thing here with the funding is it takes a hell of a lot of time to do research in the real world. And I think the world at the moment is going from what used to be these big 10-year projects, 5-year projects. Suddenly it's like 2 year, 1 year, 3 months, a month, a week. And yet, if you want to engage with people, it's a little bit like learning a musical instrument. You have to spend many, many hours doing that in order to appreciate what it can do and build trust. This is a social thing, it's not technical. You have to go out there and listen to people and sort of develop and appreciate an understanding that you're a person, they're a person, and that it's kind of sort of in a strange sort of way, it's a friendship that you build up with people. But I do think it's a bigger research culture question.
Yeah, 100%. Just think it's systematic of the
Yeah.
flaws of the UK academic and grant funding system and what no one has actually done. Maybe it has been done and I just don't know about it. And I can only speak of the UK. You might have it elsewhere in Europe, but there needs to be a research institute that just focuses on, or a consultancy that just focuses on how helping researchers embed or bring in different types of people from different backgrounds early on into the conceptual stage, the thinking stage of research projects. And no one has, to my knowledge, has addressed this. There's a missing gap. And I'm talking about more of an organization, not just about a research project, but there needs to be a facilitator to help everyone do this. And I'm not just talking about social scientists or humanities. I'm talking about engineers, computer scientists, roboticists, anyone working in this domain where they need to kind of include different types of stakeholders, also public and the patients involved in the actual thinking and recruitment. It's almost like a recruitment agency for researchers and research projects to bring in people. I'm sure maybe it does exist, or if it does exist, no one knows about it so much. But I think that really we need to do better about that. And yeah, and Alan's point about kind of the continual engagement and this kind of longitudinal aspect of things, where it's systematic of the flaws of the UK funding system, where once we finish one research project, we're all clawing, chomping at the bit, trying to write a new bid for another project. And of course, the legacy of that previous project just dissipates, it disappears, and the web page stops, no visibility around it again. And then we don't really actually find any meaningful impact of whether our research project has actually had any kind of meaningful impact on the world, because we need to go to the next
Yeah.
funding. Our university is putting pressure on us. Some of us are on fixed term contracts, so we have to kind of think of new ideas all the time and write new bids. We never really have this kind of the luxury of seeing whether an intervention actually works in society. And I think public health even also struggle with this public health kind of aspect of things. Yeah, I'm kind of going down a public health angle here, but I think we could adopt or learn a lot from that domain and bring it into our domain, especially for the robotics community, when we implement a new tool or a new interface or a new kind of soft robot that helps people with musculoskeletal issues. Does it actually work after 2 years, 3 years? How are people experiencing that in the course of a 3-year project ultimately? These are really tricky questions, and they're more
Yeah.
systemic
I
issues.
think I've never th you've made me think now. I've never thought about the issue about having, yeah, are there any implications for having people or in some places where you've got possibly 70%, perhaps 100% of staff on fixed term con research contracts, and that they can't progress. And they're looking for new contracts. I wonder how that, if you're working in public health, does that have a negative impact upon the research and those people involved in that ecosystem? And perhaps this is illogical, but there must be, is there a relationship between public health and the research that's the research system? Are there better ways where long-term research could have better impact upon the public's health? I don't know. It's a strange way to think about the ecosystem, isn't it? In that, and who's making those decisions about how long a project can be, and who's sitting on the boards of those organizations? It's amazingly complex when you start to think about research culture and systems, because there are hundreds of stakeholders involved in the space.
Yeah, there's been a couple of things that have been brought up, and one was around incentives and talking about funding, and then the other was this idea of having an institution and having this institutional organization. The third one was groups, so because you mentioned socioeconomic groups and older people, especially because I think sometimes is this old problems, new technology. We can go back with the history of medicine, and there's been so many people that have been left out of medical treatments, including women, children. This big thing as well, they're not included in a lot of these conversations. And then there's all the vulnerable groups and marginalized groups as well. And then the last one was this like public health idea as well. How has engaging with communities, the public, or patients shaped your career, motivations, and goals? And how has these different types of funding issues that you've mentioned played into that as well?
Wow, what a question. So yeah, so how has engaging with people and patients shaped my career? Okay. I think it brings a dose of reality, doesn't it? I think when you do classify yourself as an academic, I think I do, had a certainly a non-linear path career trajectory compared to the majority of academics. Forgive me if that is an assumption, but I've definitely had a non-linear academic route, put it that way. And what that has allowed me to do is see the gap. It's actually a question of simulation. It's a question of reality gap, the reality gap between academic papers and these kind of thought experiments that we talk about, and actually the real world, if what we do actually has an influence on the real world. And it's something that I still actually wrestle with as a social scientist, because I would like to have an influence on everyday life. I would like to have an influence or make meaningful, help shape the world in some way. If I'm being critical and maybe too honest, probably not. One project that has given me hope recently was Kate Reid's project on Remembering Baby, and where she won Kate Reid is a sociologist of medicine, a medical sociologist, and she won a major grant, ESRC grant, on postnatal, looking at the kind of medical technologies and the invisible labor around baby death, basically. And sure, she was doing an academic study, an academic work, publications in social science medicine, but she also, I think it was quite by accident, she ended up talking to a lot of the invisible people that were involved in the decision making around what do we do with dead babies, ultimately. This kind of this matter out of place, the kind of, it's a taboo, it's pure taboo. It's just something that people do not want to talk about. And is a really difficult topic to talk about. And Kate Reid's research was something that really inspired me and said, like, this, if there is a good example of kind of public engagement and inclusivity, this is how you do it. But then at the same time, it was kind of accidental as well. So it's kind of like, how do you kind of plan for this, you know, in a research proposal? How do you structure for this? How do you anticipate this as well? And there are tools out there in how we do this and how we do it better. Stilgo and Richard Owen's framework, Responsible Innovation, which provides us with a theory methods toolkit to build in or kind of develop research alongside participants and stakeholders, and ensuring that, you know, all different types of voices are included. And I think we are getting better from a practice point of view of engaging public and making sure that our research is more inclusive. But we, again, and it's getting better, that it's better now than it was like actually 5 years ago. But we still always hit the brick wall of money. If there are funding, if there's a kind of a vehicle for funders to kind of go, oh, let's kind of fund this public engagement bit further and actually pump some research or resources into this area. I think actually Wellcome did have a public engagement fellowship or grant, but I think they pulled it for some reason. I don't know. But I think there needs to be more kind of research bodies that just focus on public engagement and actually do these types of exhibitions that make matters meaningful for the public and things that really resonate with them as well. And I guess, you know, that I've talked about it a little bit too long there, but that's why I'm interested in public engagement. I feel like still as an academic, I'm not doing enough. And I feel like I'm just doing it for the purposes of my own career and to pay the bills ultimately. And that's the brutal, harsh reality of what we do. But if we can, but at the same time, I want to use my power and my privilege to do better with public engagement and inclusivity. And I was really happy to be involved with the TAS project, where we did do bits around that. And that has kind of influenced and shaped my expertise around this a little bit further. But I think I can do better. We all can do better. And I think public funding bodies can also do better as well.
So I think in terms of my career, I suppose a little bit in a similar way to Peter, do not come from, I would say in terms of, I'm a working class person. So none of my family went to university, and it's probably seen as a very untrustworthy, people would not, on the whole, perhaps I'm generalizing, most of my family would not trust research from those people in academia, because on the whole, I guess, and I've got no stats in front of me, I wonder whether people in academia are representative of the wider population in the first place. So, and that, you know, whether that's in terms of the Equalities Act or in terms of characteristics that are not looked at in terms of the Equalities Act, like social, socioeconomic status. So I think when I did get into academia, it was, yeah, a sort of fantastic place to be in, because you realise you're as intelligent as everybody else and it offers opportunities that you can take. And I, to be honest, I found it really easy compared to working in jobs that I'd previously have and had. And they paid you for doing things that were kind of nice to do and enjoyable. At the same time, there's a bit of a kind of crisis of identity here, isn't there? In that, like, hold on, I'm from this background, this is the way I would do stuff. Ooh, look, we're not engaging with those people that I'm part of. And why on earth would you do a psychological study, class it as science, and your research is based on like 30 students and some academics that are not representative of, and then it's kind of repurposed. And so I've always found it a little bit odd. And I think that, you know, I started off doing more critical theory stuff, maybe a bit of stuff around gender, colonialism, sexuality, all those good projects where you could find real taboos. And taboos are part of the discourse of critical theory, really. And I kind of ended up in computer science. Bit of an odd place to be in some respects, because got a bit of arts interest to my academic focus. So I ended up in the mixed reality lab, and I thought, yeah, well, I'm in this space now. There's all this like cool stuff happening, cool tech, or what do people, yeah, that kind of idea where it's all about the tech. I was very much grounded when I started suggesting, actually, you know what, all this stuff is very city focused on these people that wear black polo necks, and let me have a look at my specs, Prada glasses, and you know, that kind of thing in the arts world. And that's great. I really enjoy it. I mean, we all love kind of engaging in that sort of stuff. And, you know, this is the world pre-iPhone, pre-mobile devices. And I started to think, well, actually, you know what? I'm interested in more rural spaces. So in terms of social capital, what is it that those spaces don't offer or people can't engage with that people in urban spaces can? And we all know, if you drop yourself in Oxford, you can have a jolly good time, probably down the road from you, Matimba. And we could probably nip into the Ashmolean, Pitt Rivers. It's kind of strange museum in some respects, all kinds of odd stuff and all kinds of things that I would have never seen as a kid. You could go into, I don't know, you've got the museum, you've got all this like what do they call it? It's like something like, it's not the glistening spires, is it, of Oxford? Perhaps I'm going off topic here, but anyway, so I started thinking about this kind of more, how do you work with people out of the lab in these spaces where people are underrepresented as a group? Individuals are made up of lots of different parts to their identity and define in different ways to the group sometimes. And we started thinking about research in the wild, going beyond the lab, going out there, actually engaging with people on their own terms, in their own space, seeing what they thought about the world and seeing how this would feed into research. I was grounded in some respects by ethnographers who work in the, I guess, more in the socio-tech area. People like Andy Crabtree, who's now my director of research, excellent scholar, Mark Rousfield, Peter Tolmie, loads and loads of people that worked in that area. So there'd always been these voices in the background that said, look, you know what, get off your backside, go and talk to people, go and look at what they do, perhaps become part of that world. If you want to understand what it's like to be a sailor, at least go sailing and attune yourself to the concerns of those people. Look at the way they reason about the world. And I think this has really almost, in some respects, become slightly, well, it has become foundational to the way I think about things. So I think now I now kind of bolt on a bit to that. I don't just go and think about and look at people. I think, what's the right thing to do in this context? Is it, it's not just about doing research of convenience. And me nipping around to Pete's on a Wednesday afternoon and saying, oh, could you pretend to cook, I don't know, some eggs and bacon, and I can put that in my report about how people use technology to cook. It's more about me thinking about how do you empower people and give them voice in research when they're not often up offered these opportunities. And how do you do that in a truthful way? Because it's not, we take it for granted as people possibly from a certain who've had certain experiences that people want to or know how to engage or have time to engage in research. And I think universities are a pretty good platform in some respects in that they do offer an interface between what might be seen as the real world and the university. But I now start to think to myself, yeah, is it just the right thing to do to engage with people? You want some sort of empathy, you want some sort of understanding, and it makes you grow as a person, and it's kind of, you develop a much more intimate understanding of your problem, and you can reflect on that. And I think Pete's articulated some things perfectly that you don't really get time to reflect on the problem anymore, or the research, or read, or go and hang out with people, or go and chat to people like we're doing now, really. And I know there's this idea of frameworks, and I know there's this idea of methods and approaches, but at the same time, as I've been working in academia, I've been a trustee of charities. And when you work in the third sector, you kind of often look at these frameworks and you think, where are they from? And the frameworks are developed by people on the ground working with people. Some, the frameworks in academia sometimes aren't. They're based on lit reviews or something like that, which is fair enough. But in my gut feeling is you've got to ask yourself, have some of the people that are coming up with these approaches, methods, frameworks, that they don't have the right to write a framework for people that they don't represent, they've never experienced, and that they are not of that world. So it's kind of like me writing a guide for both of you to how you use your house. So, and this is not a negative thing. I think this is a common sense thing. And I think we have to bear it in mind that when we are trying to develop frameworks, that sometimes high level frameworks and high level ways of doing things are so obvious that anybody could probably write them. But if you want something that's meaningful and appropriate, authentic, truthful, you use one of those horrible words that are responsible, Peter, trustworthy.
Don't go there.
Yeah, you almost have to. Why aren't we engaging with people more to come up with these kind of methods and approaches? Why aren't we just like, you know, take it? This we had a project called Fold's Future Mundane, funded by EPSRC, and it was about looking at the way that people might engage with AI and robotics, underpinned, might I add, by BBC research and development. We put all this tech, this is Lancaster and Nottingham, this tech in a caravan and took it on the road. So some places we just parked up and said, well, take part in the experience, come and tell us what you think. It was that simple. But, you know, it's career-wise, how does this all feed into career, Peter? I don't know, because we kind of... I think Pete and I both represent research-focused staff at our universities in some respects. You do realise that, yeah, if you go off the beaten track, it's possibly not that great for your career. On the other hand, if you can support people, support another human being, we're all essentially responsible for each other. So giving somebody a hand, I mean, it's not a bad thing to do, is it?
Yeah, it's. I think what you said really it was quite profound about we just don't have time to reflect. And I feel like I haven't developed intellectually. I don't feel like I am where I should be intellectually because I've had such a non-linear trajectory. And also the turnaround time for research projects and publications, but also writing big grants and just competing. It's a real detriment to us, but also how we kind of therefore build really, really good research grants that, you know, that are really useful. And yeah, I think that whole kind of thing that you said about having empirically grounded frameworks instead of like literature frameworks, you know, this, I think that's so spot on. And I think this is why I really do value Tricia Greenhalgh's NAS, non-abandonment, scale up, spread out sustainability framework of healthcare technologies, because it's built on empirical research. And it's still not actually that, if I have a feeling if that had more purchase early on, and that was actually embedded into kind of AI technology better, we would be spending our money, the NHS and the government would be spending their money more wisely on the rollout of these technologies, because it's very likely that 9 out of 10, there is a statistic, someone, I think her name is Jessica Morley, she's a philosopher, an ethicist, she worked under Floridi in Oxford, and she uncovered a statistic like something like, I think it's like only 5% of medical technologies actually make it to market or get actually routinely embedded. And I think someone somewhere has actually buried that statistic, because that just says, well, it's more about employment, you know, doing research and innovation, developing medical technologies or healthcare technologies, and more about economic growth and making sure that we employ people and contributing to the economy, than it is actually making sure that these technologies are useful and that they'll be used, you know? It just so happens that Jessica, and I didn't know this as well, but she has used the NAS framework when I saw her present recently. So we're on the kind of same wavelength. So she knows quite critically how important it is to have this buy-in from people, stakeholders, and not just end users, public and the patients, but also bringing in the collaborative aspects. And actually only very recently, we have seen a lot of AI models. And this is one of the reasons why we had the AI winter in medicine in the first place, because a lot of these diagnostic supports, what were they called? Computer diagnostic support systems. You know, there was a particular acronym, I've forgotten what it's called. They were all developed by computer scientists. And they amazingly, they just didn't have any clinicians embedded into the actual design. Even so, we're not even talking about patients of the public here. We're just talking about clinical experts who actually are the ones, the end users, using these technologies. And only very recently, I would say in the past like 8 years, 9 years, we've seen better. Computer scientists are actually going, actually, my model doesn't mean anything. I can make professor and publish crazy by just doing laboratory, validation tests in the laboratory. I can stress test my model on data, but it's just laboratory results. It's retrospective stuff. It's not clinical trials. But and that's where we need to go, really, ultimately. And it, and computer scientists know that. And I think up until very recently, it's almost like a suicide mission for computer scientists and engineers to take the performance of their model and test it in the real world, because that would uncover the limitations, the risks, the issues, and actually ultimately the probable failure of the machine because of the complexity, the messiness, the unpredictability of real clinical worlds, but also real clinical patients who do not do as they're told. This is why technologies fail, is because these people are just. And why public engagement inclusivity is really, really important. This new range of, these validation studies, if we are going to, if these technologies, for example, are going to be routinely accepted, again, these people need to be brought in much earlier, especially collaboration with different types of experts from, clinical experts, biomedical people, physicists, cardiologists, working alongside and having working relationships with computer scientists and data scientists developing these technologies. So it's also a problem of collaboration as well between different types of spheres and domains.
I think as well, one of the things that you said that sort of chimed with me is when you take theoretical models or whatever you want to call them out into the real world and test them, you immediately run up against, you find out where their edges are, don't you, and where they work and where they don't, maybe. But what's also interesting is, I think for me, it's if I go out and chat to people or discuss things with people or look at what they're doing, or it shows the edges of my understanding of the world. But I think, sometimes engaging with people, it's very a very, very obvious thing to say. If you engage with people, the scales fall away from your eyes as an individual researcher, and you're able to see something about the world that you wouldn't normally. This is not about bias in a negative way. It's, again, as Pete said, it's about reality. And I think that sort of stuff takes time and reflection. You need time to kind of sit and think and understand what's actually happened. And if we're not doing that, and things are just being rushed out for the sake of words on paper, which is all some of this stuff is it that we do need an institute, or do need to kind of work with funders, perhaps more as research-focused staff, as the people that do this work on the ground, to think about how we can empower other researchers to get time and develop capacity and support some of those researchers that are underrepresented in the research ecosystem, to give them more voice so that they can do work in order that we get more representation and get better understandings? If we're thinking about this in terms of science, true impact, and efficiency is the wrong word, isn't it? It's about doing the best thing for people. It's effective. It's kind of, that's what you want, isn't it? Effective and works. Then maybe there needs to be funding. I know we've just got some funding at Nottingham to support underrepresented research-focused staff or people that work in the research ecosystem, which is ginormous, to develop their careers if there have been barriers put in place. But in some respects, it sounds so obvious as a thing to do. But doing this stuff, you need to get multiple holders on board.
I think also I can imagine this consultancy, I can imagine this research institute as nothing like the Wellcome building. I'm going down the route of infrastructure now. We exclude people in so many different ways that the first thing that we do is through our buildings. unfortunately, which represent our colonial past. And we already know that our buildings are just not especially, well, I mean, even modern buildings are not equipped for people with disabilities and visual impairments. But the Welcome building, I mean, I'm sure that'll be removed in this maybe, but I've been there a few times and it's so, such a punitive, exclusionary building, despite preaching engagement, funding into medical technology. I've never been made to feel like a deviant when I go there, because the way the barriers are set up and people looking at you, and I was escorted when I went to the toilet and I had someone waiting outside the toilet waiting for me and told that I only have a few minutes in there. You know, it's these kind of questions. So my vision for, you know, this kind of research institute would actually be something that welcomes the public and patients from all different kind of socioeconomic backgrounds, where they look at the building and they're not intimidated by it. When you look at these kind of buildings, maybe it's like Fleet Street or wherever it is, you know, all these kind of big government and all these big research funding buildings, they're all got this kind of colonial, very imposing sometimes, you know, and when you go in there, the way it's been organized and structured, it just isn't welcoming. But if you're going to do this kind of research institute, or whatever you want to call it, it has to be where I'm Joe Bloggs, a member of the public that lives in Croxteth in Liverpool, you know, traditional working class background. I know that I can go to this research institute and feel welcome. It's not going to look at me and exclude me. You know, I feel I can go there, and I've got an appointment. I've got a meeting with a research group who are looking to put a bid into the EPSRC, and I've got an appointment, and there's a cozy, there's a soft kind of area, it's soft lighting, it feels like I'm welcome here despite my background and who I am and where I come from, kind of thing. And I think we need to do better structurally to kind of welcome and include people in these types of things. But again, that's a question of structure and infrastructure and building design as well. So I'm not just talking about, you know, kind of research projects, but also everything else around it, you know. And again, it comes down to money and space.
Well, I'd go further on that one, Pete. If you think about the way that things happen or the way they're funded, often you're seeing this. I don't know if this is true or not, but sometimes if you want to be inclusive and you want to get people to participate, you need to think about identities based on where they're from. And I think that rather naively, if you invest a ginormous amount of money in a certain place and ignore other places, then you're not doing work on a national level. So you know, and I know, it's like Northern Ireland, Wales, Scotland, England. And then within all of those places, there's kind of urban and rural. And you'll probably see money synced into the capitals of those areas.
Right, yeah. So,
and also, you know, as well as I do, as somebody who speaks some Welsh, it's kind of linguistically, yeah, some of those areas, you're going to get sort of Gaelic, Welsh, English, various other languages spoken, hardly ever accounted for in research, to be honest. And then you start to think, hold on, this is even crazier. The legislate, if you look at devolution, as we're heading towards further devolution, most of those nations, those countries or areas or what our regions, some people call them, but they do sort of identify as countries like Wales, Scotland, England. There's a whole raft of individual and very context-specific legislation in place. So, for example, if I was at University X in country X, and I'm just thinking that my research is going to have a UK-wide impact, even the fact that somebody's not bothered or doesn't understand that you need to go out there and participate with different areas of the UK to really appreciate where, if you're doing some, certainly doing something around healthcare, policing, socioeconomics, or all of those big areas, education, aging, you really need to go and appreciate what these different areas do and the way that they work together. Because sometimes you can look at things like, for example, I got some colleagues, they're talking about well-being. I go to Wales, I notice there's a Well-being Future Generations Act. There's legislation, there's law there. It's embedded within all statutory organisations that this stuff has to happen. So then you might reflect on that, and like Peter's like rather sort of cleverly articulated, it might not necessarily be that there's like a there's a centre, but perhaps those people are informing engagement and can support real world engagement via those kind of strategies and policies and legislation that's in place. I mean, it might be the case within the next few years that we end up with, I mean, I don't know how this works. I'm not part of it, but it might be that research funding is regionalized.
Nice, yeah.
So that you end up with a regional approach. I mean, it's not going to solve issues, whereas if a region decides to put all their money into Alan's metropolis and not into other areas, but at least with those sorts of mechanisms, you can ensure that the research is appropriately related to the issues within that nation.
And I wonder if having an institution that was actually not made by researchers to do this, but also made by members of the public, and maybe it could be something that reflects community centres a bit more in terms of like somewhere where people would actually want to go and is within the community, or something that moves. When Alan mentioned the van, when they drove up to Lancaster, so it could be something like that. Going back to also what you said about Welsh, even something as simple as having signatures, everybody's email signatures in English and Welsh, wouldn't happen outside of Wales. Whereas I do notice when you get emails from researchers in New Zealand, they will have it in English and in the Maori language as well a lot of the time. So yeah, just wonder why that is. I've never really thought about that. And even getting basic informed consent forms in what I don't think we'd ever do them in Welsh, but unless you're in Wales or working with Welsh people, maybe it should be something that's automatic, like in places like Spain, where you would have it in Spanish, in Catalan, probably maybe in the Basque language as an option. One of the things I found with public engagement, I've actually been asked this outright, is like, is this just for middle class people? So it is a serious problem in the UK. I think people do not talk about the class system as much as they should, especially when you're working with universities. I think people do think this is not an institution that represents me. It doesn't relate to me at all. This research doesn't relate to me as much as it should. But when you consider kind of our, like, the society that we live in and how that also influences us, what is our responsibility as researchers, considering some of these issues that you've mentioned? Is it a public health issue sometimes with these things that happen with short-term contracts, with the way we have to do research? What kind of tips and insights would you like to give to kind of future researchers and practitioners?
I suppose that the sort of the reality of it is, if you went and looked at organisations and looked whether you or any way that you identify was represented in that organisation, and it wasn't, then there's a big issue there, isn't there? And I suppose that issue sits on multiple levels. From, do they get public funding? How are they engaging? Do they want to represent you? I mean, like you said, Matimba, class is a very strange issue, which is often avoided about being, people are not comfortable about talking about it, have you noticed? And it's because I think somebody said to me, it was quite high up in academia, said, because I sound like I'm working class, people think I'm stupid. This is in the real world. And that's somebody who's kind of like a professor at a university. And I thought, you know what? I come from that background. I never even thought that, but you kind of, yeah, it's about people's perceptions about you because of certain characteristics that you've got. So there is a job that needs to be done, I think, to make people comfortable in settings that they're not comfortable in. And I think Peter was pretty good at articulating. Sometimes you look at these spaces, and I've often thought about this, is so, you know, I'm going to do something impactful, and I'm going to do it in this really, really important gallery that's got billions of pounds, and they're going to give me a really uncomfortable stall to sit on so I can talk at people about stuff. And that's impactful and engagement, because it's like, you know, it's really fancy. But then I think, but is it really impactful? And is it really engaging to have somebody just blow hot air at people for half an hour and wave my arms about? And although I am entertaining, so people told me, it feels much more valuable use of my time to go out to and chat to people one-to-one sometimes at a community centre. And I think what I've thought about in the past and more recently is, if I was going to advise somebody, I would think, you know, it's you're in an academic system where you publish work, it's about your research, it's about your thoughts about the world. There are perhaps people in that world that are not representative of the wider ecosystem, but you might not be representative of the academic ecosystem that you're in. So there's all these conflicts, aren't there, around the issues around identity and the barriers that are put in place and the perception that others have about you and that you have about them perceiving you, which can lead to kind of lack of confidence, or, you know, keeping your mouth shut, or doing things in a different way. But I think essentially you need to develop some confidence to actually articulate that, because there are lots of people for a variety of different reasons that do think in the same way that you do. And I think if we all sit there and keep our mouths shut and our eyes closed and put our fingers in our ears, then, you know, we'll be trapped in our own heads. Whereas what we really want is for somebody like you to say, well, actually, you know, I've noticed this. And I say, well, I've noticed that. And you say, yeah, I've noticed this. And you kind of build up a culture that is sort of supportive and people don't feel left behind. At the same time I'm saying that, I'm aware that if you are in a position where you're just starting out in academia, or you're on a fixed term contract, or you're working in an area which is perhaps new or certainly avant-garde or at the cutting edge of what you're doing, then it must be amazingly stressful if you've got a burning issue that you think you can really kind of, where you can really engage and have some impact, which is kind of just in a social way, righteous research, maybe that's a term for the institute. Yeah, it must be quite scary. You must sit there and think, well, actually, shall I say anything? I don't want to rock the boat. Lots of people are just doing this stuff, and they've got lots of publications, or they're seen as important. But I don't know, from experience, I think you should kind of, you know, think about being authentic and true, because if you're working with people who actively try and suppress what you've got to say, then, you know, you need to raise that, and you need to kind of, you don't want to encourage that sort of behavior, because that's the sort of behavior from individuals and organizations where they institutionalize things like belittling, and they hold people back on purpose, which I don't know. I mean, perhaps I'm drifting into sort of northern negativity here. I don't think that's what a majority of people want to see, that they want to be engaged in something which is positive, which is sort of bringing issues to light. They want to solve problems. They don't want to sink people. They want good stuff to happen. So it's been fascinating to hear what you've both had to say in this area, because, yeah, hopefully somebody somewhere will listen to it and give Pete 50 million quid to open his centre in North Powys or somewhere, bilingually.
The hub of the community, and I'll call it Righteous Research.
Righteous Research, yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah, I agree with everything Alan said. That, so I think it's being mindful of your gender, first of all, and your race, and, you know, your identity and where you come from. I mean, I'm speaking maybe for Alan and I, but here, you know, we don't, I mean, I guess we do, as fixed term researchers, we do put our life on hold because there are waves of unemployment. But again, being white and male, we're still privileged where we don't have to think about children in a sense, and losing time. And statistics do show how difficult it is for women who drop out of highly paid careers. It's really difficult for them to kind of get back to where they once were. Organizations putting barriers in place, stopping them from rehiring them or at the salary that they were. And I think there are mechanisms that are just really difficult. And in terms of tips, I think it is about being mindful of who you are and where you are, realizing your privilege and your power. I guess this is what it's all about, in writing research, in doing research, but also interacting and engaging with people and with participants, and of course not treating them as objects, not treating them as data points in a paper or an Excel spreadsheet. I'm always aware. I try and do my best to. It's something that we don't do well enough. Is I still think academia is way too middle class, and again, that's a systemic thing. But then it's difficult then, right? Because what is middle class? It's a constantly shifting concept and term now. Because you've got now middle class people. You've got partners, for example, who are well educated, degree, master's, PhD, yet they're struggling to pay the bills. Historically, or from a classification sense, based on their education and their parents, they went to university, they're middle class, but they can't afford a deposit to buy a house, right? Or, they're struggling with winter bill payments and things like that. And now they've got a kid, they've now brought a child into the world, and that picture becomes even more complex. So now you a middle class, me and my partner earn a good amount of money, or whatever's good in, or more than the average of the UK, yet we still have to budget. And actually, I might have to go without lunch tomorrow, or that coffee, to afford like baby formula. So this middle class thing is a really complicated and a contested term, as we would say. It will depend on who you speak to and which community. And I just think it, and again, it's to be mindful of that. And in terms of tips I would give researchers, well, this is the problem. Be mindful about everything. But if you are mindful about everything and really empathetic and really, dare I say it, responsible and understanding, it's dangerous because you'll burn yourself out. You'll burn yourself out.
I was just thinking of that actually, about the burnout, because it's kind of you get to a position where you can support. If you work in academia and you're at a university which is supportive, and I've worked at Nottingham for a long time, and they've always supported me. And when I've worked with people at Oxford and Aberystwyth University, people have been amazingly supportive, and it gives you the opportunity to then pass on some of that privilege. By touching things that are gold, you get a little bit of that, and people respect you, and you can have a certain amount of influence. So you are in a privileged position, but at the same time, it's not I don't know about burnout, but it does take a significant amount of energy to get things back on track for people. That mindfulness kind of is where the burnout is, because you're constantly thinking, actually, how could I help this person? This is not working for them, because no matter where you work, people are people. But if you can help somebody, then you can kind of just do it. But if you have that mindset all the time, then it's going to use up your time and your energy, and then you can probably start to feel quite grumpy that somebody's not doing something that they should be doing, and you start to get quite negative about the system. And I think lots of people are at the moment. Academia changed massively, and it's gone from being an organization where you had students and you had professors who professed stuff, and the students learnt, and you did your research on the side. Well, now suddenly we're in a position where there are all these different disciplines that range from engineering to medicine to philosophy to applied philosophy. Technology has a social element to it. This means that we have to, engage with each other to understand what's happening. And it's a big old world, isn't it, now? It's not as it was. So I think the research culture has changed dramatically, and we're trying to kind of see still trying to see where we fit within that system, which, as Pete said, is like, you know, still moving about. It's a bit wobbly. One minute we're doing this, one minute we're doing that.
We have got the tools, and at Bristol we've got public engagement who do facilitate routes into these kind of public outreach events. But what I have, you know, being critical of these events again, though, is that they're really time sensitive. They tend to be for middle class children or middle class public. For example, Festival of Tomorrow, which was at the Deanery Academy. And I've never seen a school more prestigious ever in my life. It was a phenomenal, beautiful, expensive school. I think it might have been independent school. I don't know. Whatever it was, it really catered for families. Well, it was a very nice school. And I was mindful of the children and some of the parents that were there, very well articulated, good grasp of knowledge and curiosity, and really had a really good knowledge of technology and AI. The case was also with a public engagement event at the HMS Britain, I think as part of Futures Festival, which we were involved in. Again, those children actually did know more about AI than I'll be honest with you. They were talking about things that I was like, how did you know that? Wow. You know, so, and of course, those were the select, especially the children that I interacted with. Yeah, it was of a certain demographic. And I think sometimes my take-home message of that was that when we are doing public engagement is with whom, and it is quite in the comfort, it's comfortable public engagement with children who are, and families who are potentially comfortably middle class, that don't have to worry about budgeting per se, their coffee or whatever. Again, that's a horrible assumption. I should never assume as a sociologist. I'll slap myself on the hand. But let's not be comfortable when we do public engagement. And I think this is a tip, this is a tool. I think this is what I would like to pass on to people, is like, let's do public engagement and building inclusivity, but not in our comfort zones. Like Alan said, go to, like, I don't know, someplace in a van and drive up to potentially a deprived area or something like that, or work out what we need to do in those types of areas, because these people matter, of course, and that's not what we're doing well. And that's why people turn around and they say, is this for middle class people? Well, it is. So far, it really is. And I want to see better engagement with different demographics, different kind of people moving forward. But of course, it's really, really difficult to do. It's a really difficult balancing act. Literacy and knowledge plays into that, because as a researcher, we're biased. We're all biased because we want the best information. And unfortunately, when we do collect data, we want kind of something to give us really cool, insightful comments in our qualitative research, our papers. And we might potentially, this is probably controversial, but we might not potentially get what we want to say if we went somewhere else that didn't have this level of knowledge or experience from a middle class kind of school, for example. There is a kind of a bias that creeps in where we know it's almost like kind of what do you call it? Sampling bias or purposeful. It's like a purposefulness in who we select to kind of interview and include into our research. I think that's one of the things in terms of what tips I would give researchers is to go outside of your comfort zone. I know it depends on the research question, but let's expand the research question into different communities, into different groups that are ultimately left behind. And that left behind research is really, really important, because it's the left behind that get excluded from models and will end up in some type of kind of court case or trial 10 years time, which the public will end up paying for. And then therein repeats this cycle. Yeah, that kind of thing anyway. But yeah, that's my thing, is to kind of go outside of your comfort zone. And that's it. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to leave it there then. Like, it's been so nice to talk to both of you. I feel like I, to be honest, I could talk to you both forever, I think, and definitely have hours and hours of conversation about this topic, and just really glad to have had you on the podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting us. Thank you.
In today's podcast, we talked about public engagement with research-related activities, research culture, access to research, the importance of public voice, unheard voices, and the social economic gap in research participation. We covered a lot. I'm glad in this series of Power and Privilege that we could discuss gaps in public and community engagement with research and academics, highlighting issues of class, both the middle and upper class nature of academic professionals, and the exclusion of lower socioeconomic groups from public engagement with research. Patient involvement and public engagement with research is something that is really close to my heart. I really hope we can move more research away from the ivory towers of universities and into the community so more people can be involved with research. Thanks for listening to a Power and Privilege in Academia podcast brought to you by Black and Brown in Bioethics. Be sure to visit blackbrownbioethics.blogs.bristol.ac.uk to listen to more of our podcasts, follow our work, and connect with our network. Credits. Thank you to the Centre for Ethics in Medicine at the University of Bristol and to the Ethox Centre at the University of Oxford for all their support. Thank you to Dr. Kasim Ashraf for providing intro and outro beats.